Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Monday, March 3rd meeting of the Senate Committee on Rules. Members, we have a full agenda today, and so I think we'll start taking the bills in the order that they appear on our agenda, which means we'll start by opening a public hearing on House Bill 4078A. Erin?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 4078A makes legislative findings, designates land in Washington County designated as rural and urban reserve in Metropolitan Resolution Number 114245, adopted March 15, 2011, as acknowledged rural and urban reserve except for certain areas specified in measure, stipulates land in Metro County planned and zoned for farm, forest, or mixed farm and forest use and not designated as urban reserve may not be included within urban growth boundary before at least 75% of land in county has been included in urban growth boundary and planned and zoned for urban uses, establishes certain property as employment land of state significance and does not count in determining employment capacity of land within Metro in first legislative review, establishes UGB as designated by Metro Ordinance Number 111264B, adopted October 20th, 2011, except for certain areas as specified in the measure, effective January 1, 2015. Metropolitan Service District is allowed to add additional year to complete inventory determination and analysis after completion of previous process, requires Land Conservation Development Commission to issue final order within 180 days after commission votes whether to approve specified decision, stipulates urban service agreement in effect on effective date of act does not apply to certain areas, requires City of Hillsborough and Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue to enter into urban service agreement for certain unincorporated communities in Washington County and report back to legislature on or before January 1, 2015, sunsets requirement for established urban serving district on December 31st, 2015, authorizes commission to approve all or part of local land use decision when acting on remand of Court of Appeals decision if commission identifies evidence in record clearly supporting all or part of decision. There is an emergency clause on the measure. There's no revenue and minimal fiscal impact on the measure before you.
Okay, thanks, Erin. And I see that we've been joined by Representatives Clem and Davis, who I know have been working extremely hard on this bill, and also Representative of the Governor's Office. So I have just had a request to not use the term grand bargain in your testimony. Anything else would be great. Senator Farioli.
I certainly appreciate you providing fair warning, but it's more than that. It's the first reference will be a no vote. The second reference will be a minority report.
Thank you for that word of caution, Senator Farioli.
And the third reference will be a bipartisan minority report.
Okay, please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Brian Clem, State Representative from District 21 and Chair of the House Rural Communities Committee that issued this bill forth with a detour in the Rules Committee on our side while we perfected the Map Adjustment Consensus Bill. That's what we call it now, Map Adjustment Consensus Bill. So in front of you, I believe you've got a color map, and those are, at least if you have one of them is over here on the right. There are a couple smaller issues that I think I'll let Richard address, but essentially the bill describes that map along with a few side issues. So the maps that you have in front of you reflect changes to what the multi-year process that eventually resulted in a LCDC vote. First it was the counties, then it was Metro, then LCDC. They put out a map. That map was litigated for a variety of reasons, and as you may recall hearing, it was in Washington County in particular sort of sent back to square one about 10 days ago. Clackamas and Multnomah counties had minor issues that were not sent all the way back to the local counties, but those issues we didn't really try and tackle. Washington County was the part that would essentially trigger years and years of new process and even maybe at the end more litigation. So the hope, I think, of all jurisdictions involved was if we could all come up with essentially a solution to the map issue and any ancillary side issues, that we could not set a bad precedent and have the legislature intervene in a situation, but instead work with local jurisdictions and community groups to reach what amounts to codifying an out-of-court settlement. So in the last 10 days, I guess I would say, say there's been quite a lot of goodwill, effort, wrangling, et cetera, to get to a map that I think you will find from the groups in the audience has reached a consensus point, hence the term somewhere up there. Oh, it doesn't say consensus on those. We have. I even labeled it the consensus map, finally, for your benefit. If you want to go through the changes in detail, we can, but essentially what happened is quite a few more rural reserves are now proposed in exchange for more certainty for three cities affected, Hillsborough, Cornelius, and Forest Grove, that they would get their UGB expansion now rather than just having urban reserves that at some point when in the metro process would come in. Theirs happen now. They give up thousands of acres of what otherwise would be urban reserves to rural reserves, which are why you have a bunch of happy farmers talking in a moment. That's the basic nature of the map. There's one area in blue that was a former rural reserve turned into an urban reserve. Otherwise, it's either urban reserve converted to rural or urban reserve converted to UGB. There's a couple side issues that I think Richard could probably cover in interjurisdictional agreements over fire service and that kind of thing. With that, I think I'll hand it over to my able colleague and co-sponsor.
Thank you, Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee. It's a pleasure to be here. John Davis, State Representative for House District 26, including Wilsondale, Sherwood, Hillsborough, much of the area you see at the bottom south of this map, including three of the four primary areas that the UGB would be established. And Representative here has talked about some of the specifics of the bill. I'd like to go up to a more 10,000-foot view about why this bill should even be considered and impact upon the economy in the state of Oregon and, in particular, Washington County and the metro region. It's been 2005 since Metro has expanded the urban growth boundary in the Tri-County area of Metro. According to some home builders, land prices are currently higher than they've ever been in the history of Oregon. Even though home prices haven't yet reached their peak where they were, land prices and the shortage of buildable land for schools, for business, and for homes are at an all-time short supply. With this bill, it would legislatively approve an essentially out-of-court settlement, as we've discussed, and as soon as it's signed, spur upwards of, we've been told, $400 million of development over the next few years. And that's not just homes. That's school districts who want to build schools. The Beaverton and Hillsborough school districts are overcrowded in all of their high schools. They are planning high schools in these areas that would be incorporated in the UGB. So we'd be building schools, we'd be providing necessary industrial land for business, and we'd be providing home sites for home builders and folks who want to provide more affordable housing in the area. So the impact would be substantial on the economy, and I hope that you'll support the bill. Thank you.
Okay, thank you for your testimony.
Good morning, Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee. For the record, Richard Whitman, Governor Kitzhaber's Natural Resources Advisor. I want to start out by just expressing the governor's appreciation for Representative Klim and Representative Davis for their hard work on this bill in terms of bringing forward a collaborative process that has resulted in a consensus on some very difficult issues. This is, as Representative Klim said, essentially a proposed codification of an out-of-court settlement that brings forward and preserves, really, the very hard work that the communities in the Portland metro area have done over the past 6 years to develop urban and rural reserves. Specifically, the bill, first of all, codifies the urban reserve and rural reserve boundaries in the Washington County portion of the metro area. I want to be clear that this bill does not affect the Clackamas County or Multnomah County urban or rural reserves, which are still going forward as part of the normal process. And second of all, as Representative Davis said, this bill is essential to move forward the metro decision that was made most recently on the metro area urban growth boundary. So this bill will both codify the Washington County portion of the reserves and allow the urban growth boundary decision of Metro to go forward. A couple of other specific things to note. Representative Klim mentioned urban service agreements. this legislation would require the service providers in a number of unincorporated communities in Washington County to work together to enter into urban service agreements to serve those unincorporated communities, and would also provide that one specific area which is affected by this decision would not be subject to an existing urban service agreement. The last thing I want to touch on along the technical lines is just there have been some questions about roads and utilities necessary to serve some of the areas that are going to be urbanized as a result of this legislation. I want to be clear, this is an issue that the Land Conservation and Development Commission looked at very carefully back in 2010, and urban road facilities and sewer and water facilities that are necessary to be put along an existing roadway in a rural area to serve an urban area that's being brought into an urban growth boundary can be accomplished without an exception to the statewide planning goals. That's the intent of this bill. So with that, members of the committee, Chair Rosenbaum, if there are any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. Thank you.
Yes, Senator Burdick.
The inclusion of Helvetia is an urban urban reserve was very was kind of a flashpoint. Can you tell us what happened to Helvetia in this plan?
So, thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Burdick, in the north of 26 area, you'll see a green box just above the City of Hillsboro. You can't see it. It's not called City of Hillsboro, but above 26, above the kind of maroon-colored converted UGB, you'll see a green box with a little point going up on the tip that says Rural Reserve and then undesignated in the corner of that.
That's Helvetia.
Yep, and that's the area that was all urban reserve. So instead it goes rural. Thank you, Vanna. It goes Rural Reserve and then a 70-acre, two 70-acre tracts that are proposed as undesignated.
Thank you. That's what I thought, but yeah. I just wanted to confirm that.
Any other questions?
Madam Chair.
Senator Farioli.
Madam Chair, this just statements. This is further confirmation, I think, that the state's land use system has become nearly unworkable when it tries to deal with very complicated multi-jurisdictional issues. That the legislature has become the land use planner of last resort. And we just, every session there's a couple of issues like this that attract people's attention. And it could be for a single constituent or, as in this case, multiple jurisdictions. That the UGB process for expansion is far too complicated and difficult. And I just would like to point out that as try as we might not to create a precedent, that you have created the MACB process, which is the Map Adjustment Consensus process. And I will be seeking assistance with urban growth expansions in the mid-Columbia that has not only the normal jurisdictional issues that we have in the Dalles and Hood River, but the additionally complicated by the existence of the scenic area. The Columbia River scenic area creates another overlay that's difficult. But all the cities in eastern Oregon are running out of industrializable lands and are facing a three-year process for a UGB expansion with possible three-year litigation or more. And people simply can't wait that long for resolution because we're trying to attract stability into our communities in the same way that you're trying to resolve issues here, protecting high-value farmland but creating enough opportunity that you can do attractive community improvements and infrastructure development. So I appreciate the innovation that is demonstrated by the MACB process, Madam Chair, the Map Adjustment Consensus process. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for your comments.
Madam Chair, Senator Farioli, one thing I do want to highlight, there was a bill that we passed last time that we're hopeful will help. It didn't apply to the metro region, but it does apply around the rest of the state, called 2254, and it was it's a fast-track UGB method that cities could use. And it wouldn't have helped here, obviously, because it didn't apply to metro. So we're hopeful that will bear some fruit. And then the other issue is This reserves deal is a different creature for us than kind of the normal UGB expansions everybody was familiar with over the years that were, you know, litigated, had problems as well. This was the first time we'd tried this for the metro region. We'd had urban reserves in a few areas, but rural reserves was a new beast. I voted for it. As it played out, I kind of regretted it. Now I can feel a little bit better that it's been completed in a satisfactory manner, but I still think we're going to have conversations about urban and rural reserves, even not just the UGB, as you indicated, need to occur, but I think we're going to have ongoing discussions about urban and rural reserves, because that is one theory to how to give more certainty. Is you know for 50 years what the plan looks like. Your UGBs become easier because you've already had the fight over what the next urbanizable area is, and you can just move quickly through that. Obviously, this one didn't go quite so quickly, but the hope is if this makes the whole urban-rural reserve process better, it could be used in other parts of Oregon without having to come back here at the end of it next time.
So I want to thank you again for working, I mean, incredibly hard, obviously, to achieve a remarkable consensus in a short period of time. I did want to give you a chance to respond to this question, though, because normally we wouldn't do it this way, and public participation and testimony, both from citizens and stakeholders, is a crucial part of remaking these boundaries. So I want to give you a chance to just say how you'd answer people that say we're doing this too quickly or without adequate public testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll say something, but Richard should also say something, because he's the one that convinced me it was important we not set a bad precedent. You know, this was the first time we've tried urban-rural reserves, as I mentioned, 50 years of trying to plan out growth, and there were literally thousands of meetings and tens of thousands of hours put into that process where the public did weigh in. The parties who ended up suing at the end, saying that they were not happy with the outcome, were all convened to reach essentially an out-of-court settlement. We're just codifying the agreement. We helped facilitate it, but if there were other people who had these kinds of lawsuits, I think our dance card is already full, as Senator Ferraioli just mentioned, with other spots around the area. I can't guarantee we can get the friends of that and the development community on board in all these areas, but I think both of us are interested in trying. It would be rare that it would be legislatively necessary. It was, I think, because it was the first time we'd ever tried urban-rural reserves that we got down to the end and found that we either do it now or we ask the jurisdictions to do this exact same MAC locally, but that could be five more years. That was the fear, I think, of the jurisdictions. And I think the key precedent is, did they request our assistance or did we do it to them? And which is a different story, obviously.
Representative Davis.
Thank you, Chair and members. First of all, it's important to note that if we zoomed out of this map, we are leaving intact 95% of the decisions that were made at the local level and by Metro. Those go untouched. The specific areas that we are addressing here are those where the litigants on both sides have come to the table and reached a consensus. So 95% of what was accepted through a seven-year public process remains untouched. The 5% that was heavily litigated, rather than going back through another 3 to 5 to 7 years of litigation, we've been able to reach a consensus with.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, it's an excellent question, and Representative Davis and Representative Clem both know when they first came to talk to our office about this bill, we basically told them no, that we were not supportive of this approach of legislating an urban growth boundary or urban and rural reserves. What changed was a couple of things that Representative Clem and Representative Davis mentioned. First of all, we had the request of all the local jurisdictions involved that this happen. And not only all the local jurisdictions, but all the parties to the litigation were at the table in a collaborative, consensus-based process to reach a decision. And in addition to that, as I mentioned earlier, this is the culmination of a six-year planning process tests that involved substantial public participation and public input before not only Metro, but each of the three counties making this decision on reserves as well. And if this decision had been sent back to Metro and the counties, I think there was a very significant chance that the entire six-year effort would fall apart and not be able to move forward. And in that very unique circumstance, the governor is supportive of this sort of effort where you have a collaborative process, where you have consensus of everybody who's involved in the litigation asking for this result. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you all for your testimony and for your work on this. And we'll let you go. Okay, we have several other people signed up to testify. I think I'll just call them in order. Sean Jillians, Randy Tucker, and Tom Black. And I don't want to have to use the egg timer, but we really don't need any lengthy testimony. I think we've heard a good introduction. If you could just quickly tell us what you have to say.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Sean Jillians today, representing a coalition of developers in Washington County, including Newland Homes, Metland, Arbor Homes, also the Oregon Association of Realtors. I think the preceding testimony pretty much covered everything I wanted to say about this process. Madam Chair, you know I've been around quite a while. This is one of the few times that Mr. Tucker and I are sitting next to each other singing the same tune, but we are both fully in support of this, and we appreciate the work of the governor's office and the legislators that you heard from before.
Thank you.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Randy Tucker. I'm Legislative Affairs Manager for Metro. As Mr. Jillian said, I think the previous panel answered a lot of the questions and said a lot of what I would have said. As you may know, a couple of weeks ago, Metro was vigorously opposed to the effort to legislatively rewrite the map of the urban reserves that had been agreed to in the region. At that time, what was being proposed represented an overriding of a local decision, and what's being proposed here today represents the codification of a local agreement between the parties, as Representative Clem has said. So Metro is fully in support of this measure going forward in the form in which you have it. I would just like to note one thing for the record. It's really important that we get urban and rural reserves on the map, because the whole point of that process was to make the urban growth boundary expansion process much simpler. In the past, Metro had to examine every acre of land around the entire perimeter of our region every time we went through the UGB process, which was every 5 years. So what we do under the urban reserves process is we only look at the urban reserves, or those are the first priority for UGB expansions, and only if we can't satisfy the land need that we have do we look anywhere else. And so this should actually simplify and make more efficient the management of the urban growth boundary in the future once we have the urban reserves and the rural reserves established. So with that, Madam Chair, I'll end my testimony. Thank you. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you.
And I have some written testimony in OLIS. I hope it's in OLIS. Yeah.
Okay, great. Please go ahead. Can you turn the mic a little bit?
Good morning, Tom.
And you don't
Black.
Need to be too close to it.
Okay.
It's pretty sensitive.
Good morning, Tom Black. I live in Hillsborough in Washington County. I'm the chair of CPO9. I'm not representing CPO9 at this. CPO9 represents an area within the city limits of city of Hillsborough, but it's a county-chartered citizen participation organization. The reason I'm here today, we were actually in the process of setting up a forum to discuss this with our citizens within our area. CPOs cover the entire county. Mine just happens to be square within the city limits of the city of Hillsborough. But it kind of concerned me how quickly things were moving along when this bill was originally initiated, I think at the beginning of February. And I was reading in the paper and keeping track of it, and I don't come down here that often. But my concern was that we're kind of moving a little too fast. And I know some legislature efforts have been putting into getting this stamped and approved and signed by the governor because they felt there was an emergency. I don't see an emergency myself. I'm sure others have a differing opinion, but there is a process here that's meant to include the public, and the very point I'm making here is we were going to have a public forum on March 10th at the Hillsborough Library to discuss this with our constituents, to have this discussion. I was out of town after the court decision was, handed down on the 20th, and apparently there were meetings going on from some of the representatives that just gave testimony that were taking place at our city hall. Never heard about it until after the fact, and it kind of ticked me off. I was wondering, I was one who actually went down to Metro and gave testimony before this decision was sent up to LCDC. I even did a little hoop trick because it takes a lot of effort to go through and be at the right meetings to give testimony, to witness what's going on. And I know there's probably others that would love to be down here today to do what I'm doing and to let you know their sentiments of being excluded from a process that should be helping us accomplish goal one. And that's what's being missed here, the whole boat. I understand the court ruling. I understand the pseudo, this bad logic. I mean, if you want to go back and follow the bad logic, we're actually in these converted UGBs rewarding those very entities that did the bad math that got us into this fix in the first place. I'm not trying to delay a process, but I do believe there's a purpose in including all the stakeholders, not just a select few that were the litigants, but others who are going to be affected in this. And it concerns me that we're sidestepping that. We're actually doing a two-step process because we're not only circumventing what the order of the court was, but we're also then rewarding those who did the wrong thing or incomplete work from the planning stage, from the leadership state of those involved who are pushing the agenda to get us to where we currently are in this fix, to put a Band-Aid on a system. And if it's broken, then what's the rush? I mean, let's get it right. Let's not just fix what was wrong with Washington County. And it seems to be we're making that one exception as well. It kind of reminds me when we elected a president a while back and the Supreme Court weighed in, and it's only for this one election, this one time. Well, in this case, it's too important with the land that we have that's a precious resource to just go and quickly make a decision. There are consequences that are coming down the pipeline for this. And if we're going to have to fix it, we should be taking more time and be more diligent about it. The one thing I did note, and I can go on a little bit more, but the one thing I didn't note, in your agenda, you have other bills that you're considering. And there's an item that is called fiscal impact of proposed legislation. Now, with this decision, apparently there's some service districts that are being added into this wording of the language. If that's the case, then there are some fiscal impacts or the potential for them. I see no report in this, and I looked online to see if there was any attachments with this bill or anything to be considered. Because if you're asking the City of Hillsborough and the Tualatin Fire District to add additional areas of required service districts, then you have, in fact, caused the financial impact for those entities, and I think there needs to be some consideration for that as well. Otherwise, it's an open price tag, and the citizen hasn't been involved, and there's a potential then they're going to have to pay that tax on that additional service. That concerns me. In the end, it's about getting people involved in the process. If we're going to just allow this bill to go forward and we're not going to follow the rule of law, then anything's a possibility here. And what's the point of spending millions of dollars and spending all that time and testimony if in the end the results are just to change the rules? It's like playing Monopoly and deciding, hey, I didn't like the way that played. I'm going to go back and redo. It doesn't work that way, in my opinion. We need to involve the public. We need to hold up goal one as it's intended to be, and you need to get public opinion before we race to the finish to get this thing done. Thank you.
Okay, thank you for your testimony. And just to clarify your comment, this bill was reviewed by our legislative fiscal office. Those are the people that analyze bills for their fiscal impact on state and local government. And they came back with a statement that it had minimal fiscal impact. That's why you don't see a statement. It says on our staff measure summary, minimal fiscal impact, and that was the result of an analysis.
I had a House Bill 4156A, which is on your agenda, so they purposely put together a fiscal impact for proposed legislation.
Correct. That's what they do when there is a fiscal impact, but when there's not one, they just say minimal
And that's based on?
Their analysis of the bill and what they get back from state agencies and local governments. Okay, Senator Starr.
Make a quick clarifying follow-up on the chair's statement. The fiscal impact is a fiscal to state government, and what you mentioned is very, very likely true. There may very well be a fiscal impact on local governments, but that's different than the fiscal impact on the state budget. So that's where there's not a fiscal as it relates to this bill.
Okay, any other questions? Okay, thank you all for your testimony. Okay, we have three more people, and I'll call them all. Inga Deckard, Jim McCarley, and Mike Dyke. If the three of you would like to come forward. And as you heard before, even though I know the magnitude of the issue, brevity is the order of the day.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Inga Deckard, and I will be brief. I am here this morning representing the City of Hillsborough, and we support this bill and encourage you all to do the same. Thank you. Happy to answer any questions.
I'll be brief as well. For the record, Jim McCauley, Government Affairs, Washington County. We, too, support House Bill 4078.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Mike Dyke. I'm the fire chief at Twelton Valley Fire and Rescue. And just in spite of the rumors, TVFNR is in support of the bill. So I just wanted to also to demonstrate our support for this bill. I've entered into the record an agreement as part of a good faith effort. And that agreement is in front of the City of Hillsborough right now and is consistent with our conversations, negotiations, and the 4078 language. With that, I'm happy to entertain any questions.
Great. Thank you. Are there any questions for these witnesses? Senator Ferrioli.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I see no one here from Clackamas County, and since I represent a smidge of Clackamas County, I'd just like to point out that there was communication between Clackamas County and the governor's office relative to future concerns, which resulted in an email from Mr. Whitman indicating that he is confirming that the governor's office will work with DLCDC and LCDC to confer closely with Clackamas County and Metro in determining how to address the portion of the remand from Oregon Court of Appeals that concerns Clackamas County. So there's assertion of an ongoing commitment to dealing with the concerns that were raised by Clackamas County in this regard. Just want to make that clear, put it on the record. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Ferrioli, for that clarification. Any other questions or comments? Okay, thank you all for your testimony. I don't have anyone else signed up to testify on House Bill 4078, so I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 4078 and open a work session on House Bill 4078A.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 4078. To the also known as the MACB bill, that's the Map Adjustment Consensus Bill, to the floor where they do pass recommendation.
Thank you. Senator Ferrioli has moved House Bill 4078A to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Motion carries. And we do need to assign carrier or carriers. Probably would be great to have co-carriers, Senator Starr and Senator Burdick. Would you be willing to co-carry? I believe you both have Washington County in your district. Great. Okay, well, we will have co-carriers, and I'll close the work session on House Bill 4078.
Excellent selection, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Ferrioli. We dodged a bullet, didn't we? Okay. So next, I will open a public hearing and work session on House Concurrent Resolution 204.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Concurrent Resolution 204 honors William Bill Johnson for being first American male to win gold medal at Olympic Games in an alpine event. This measure has no revenue, no fiscal impact, and comes to you with unanimous support from your House.
And I see that we've been joined by the good representative, Greg Matthews. Please go ahead and tell us about this resolution.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Greg Matthews, State Representative, House District 50, which is the great city of Gresham. This resolution comes to you a little bit late. I want to thank the great Senate President Peter Courtney for allowing the hearing and your time as well, Madam Chair. Thanks for scheduling this. Came to me through John Canzano of the Bald Faced Truth, 750 The Game. He was doing kind of a highlight of Bill Johnson, and Bill Johnson is someone who's in my community and somebody I've responded on multiple times. He's currently in a rehabilitation facility. Bill Johnson, as many of you might recall, in 1984 became famous for being the first gold Olympic medalist from the United States. So he's our first American gold medalist in alpine skiing. This is not your average Cinderella story. It's not one of those feel-good stories. It's just one of those things I think is necessary and deserving. Bill struggled as a kid. He was born in California. At the age of 7, moved to Oregon right around the age of 9, I think. Was living in Brightwood, Oregon, was skiing our slopes and many of the slopes that many of us may have skied on, and was having a tough time. When he was 17, he was caught yet another time for hanging out with the wrong crowd, and he was a car thief. And the judge actually ordered him to make a choice. You can either go to jail or you can go to ski school. And Bill chose wisely. He went to ski school. Now, Bill will be the first one to tell you he's not an athlete. He just skis fast, and that's what he's always kind of ran by. He was kind of a wild card. In fact, when he was new to the circuit for the World Cup, he had won that race, and I believe that was in Switzerland, in Wengen. Back then, if you were a skier of any type, even recreational like myself, Franz Klammer, Ingemar Stenmark, and Peter Mueller were kind of my heroes. When I would get in the tuck position down, going down the blue face of ski bowl, I would think, you know, that's who I am now. 84 changed that. It became Bill Johnson. Bill Johnson was a kid when he got off the plane at the Olympics. He basically said, "You guys are all racing for second and third place. I've got first wrapped up." He predicted he'd win the gold medal, and he did. It wasn't until later in life that that Bill would actually, you know, realize that there might be more to life than just that gold medal. He was married. He had some kids, and unfortunately, at the age of about 13 months, I believe, one of his sons died in a tragic accident. Bill's wife left him. He was left by himself living in a trailer at about 40 years old and thought, you know, one more comeback. If I could just get an Olympic gold, if I could be on the USA team again, I could get everything back. And it was during that that effort that Bill had what you can see is the worst ski crash ever on Google or YouTube. So you can find Bill's accident on YouTube. You'll see that he flies through the gates and actually spins out over the fence and flips around several times and comes to rest after his head strikes a pole. Bill had a traumatic brain injury, was comatose for 3 weeks, and basically prognosis wasn't good. But he learned to walk, talk, eat, everything again. In fact, he skied again. But unfortunately, those injuries have now gotten the better of Bill. Bill currently resides in Gresham. He is in a rehabilitation center, and it's just a tragic story. He's currently only mobile through the use of a mechanical wheelchair, so you know, automated wheelchair, and he speaks while using a board that moves the letters from yes to no. As I said, I've seen Bill probably in the last 5 months, again, just to be reminded about where he's been and where he's at. As I said, not a fun story to tell, but certainly deserving when you recognize what he accomplished. I was a little surprised, Madam Chair, to be honest, that it's been 30 years and this body hadn't noticed that he was our citizen and had won the gold medal. So I felt it appropriate to do that with the Olympics going on, that we would try to get this done. So that's what brings us here today. With any luck, we'll get his mom, DB Cooper Johnson, or Johnson Cooper, here for the day, if you so move to pass this resolution. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much for bringing this to us, and I'm sure we can accommodate her schedule if she can be here sometime this week.
That'd be great.
Any questions? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thanks for indulging me, and thank you to the chair. Thank you.
And we don't have anybody else signed up to testify. Vice Chair Ferrioli.
Madam Chair, I move House Concurrent Resolution 204 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation.
Thank you. Senator Ferrioli has moved HCR 204 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion? Any objection to the motion? Motion carries. And Senator Monis Anderson has requested to carry this on the floor, so we'll ask her to do that. And I'll close the work session on HCR 204. And I'll open a public hearing and work session on Senate Concurrent Resolution 206. Erin?
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Concurrent Resolution 206 establishes deadlines for pre-session filed legislative measures for 2015 regular session of the 78th Legislative Assembly. There is no revenue, no fiscal impact on the measure.
Thank you, Erin. And I see that we have Dana Richardson from the Senate President's Office as well as our Secretary of the Senate here. No, he is here, but he doesn't want to talk to us. Okay, so Dana, if you'd please go ahead and just explain this to us.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Dana Richardson, Legislative Director for the Senate President Peter Courtney. The committee staff is bringing around to you a calendar representation of what is in the concurrent resolution. And the concurrent resolution deals with setting pre-session filing dates for requesting measures, for measures being returned, and for measures being filed. So the calendar I've distributed picks up in July of this year. We have legislative days in May as well that you won't see here, but the legislative days are represented in blue. Those are set by leadership. They've already been established. The three dates in orange are the three that are represented in the concurrent resolution. So the Monday following our September legislative days, pre-session requests would be due. Pre-session requests for legislation would be due. Legislative Council has until December 5th to work on those and return those to members and committees. And then following our December legislative days, the Friday following the week of our December legislative days, so Friday, December 19th, is when those measures would need to be filed with the desks in order to be pre-session filed for the 2015 legislative session. I'm happy to take any questions.
Yes, Senator Scar.
Thank you, Dana. Thanks for being here. How do these dates align with our experience?
Last time?
Yeah.
They're the same.
Answer that question. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you very much for your explanation. And Senator Farioli?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, I move SCR 206. To the floor with a be adopted recommendation.
Thank you. Senator Farioli has moved SCR 206 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation. Is there any discussion on his motion? Any objection to the motion? Motion carries. And Senator Farioli, would you like to carry this?
Yes, ma'am.
On the
floor? Thank you, ma'am.
Okay. I'll close the work session on SCR 206. And that completes our public hearings, and we have two other bills that were heard previously. So I'll start by opening a work session on House Bill 4133A. And Erin, would you like to refresh our memories about this one?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 4133A was previously heard on February 25th. The measure directs Legislative Council and Oregon Department of Justice to review statute laws and identify those that are outdated, obsolete, or duplicative of other laws. It authorizes Legislative Council in consultation with the Department of Justice to prepare measures for odd-numbered year regular session to repeal or amend statutes so identified, requires report explaining reason for statutory modification to accompany each measure and be included in legislative records, limits the amendments to measures drafted under these provisions, sunsets on January 2nd, 2018, declares emergency effective upon passage. You have an A2 amendment which removes limitation on amendments on measures drafted under this process. You have an A3 amendment requires a required report for prepared measures be distributed to senators and representatives and otherwise made available to the public at least 90 days prior to start of legislative session at which measure is to be considered. You have no revenue impact, minimal fiscal impacts on both of the amendments before you and on the underlying measure.
Okay, thanks, Erin. So I'm sorry, I was a little bit distracted. So we do have two amendments to this, correct?
We do.
An A2 and an A3.
Correct.
Would you just explain those two?
I did.
Okay, great.
Would you let me?
No, I know what they are.
Okay.
So
great.
Okay, so members,
can
I think...
Can we move the amendments and move the bill?
I think so. Vice Chair Farioli?
Madam Chair, would you like single motions for each amendment, or shall we do them?
Erin, what? Can we do both in one motion, or should we?
Do them singly.
Okay. Let's do them one at a time.
Yes, ma'am. Madam Chair, I move the Dash A2 amendment to House Bill 4133A
Senator Ferrioli?
I move that it be adopted, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Senator Ferrioli has moved adoption of the -A2 amendment to House Bill 4133A. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Motion carries. Senator Ferrioli?
Madam Chair, I move that the -A3 amendment to House Bill 4133 be adopted.
Thank you. Senator Ferrioli has moved the -A3 amendment to House Bill 4133A. Is there any discussion on that amendment? Any objection? Motion carries. Senator Ferrioli.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 4133A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Vice Chair Ferrioli has moved House Bill 4133A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Motion carries. I believe that Senator Boquist has done some work on this bill. I think was responsible for one of these amendments. So how about if we ask him if he'd like to carry it on the floor? If not, we'll regroup and find someone else to do it. Okay? And I'll close the work session on House Bill 4133A. And members, we'll stand at ease for just a moment. Committee will come back to order. And did I open the work session already? Okay, I'll open a work session on House Bill 4156A. And Erin.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 4156A was originally heard on February 27th. It's the measure that authorizes Department of Human Services to appear as party in juvenile court proceeding without appearance of Attorney General at any hearing held after a hearing required under current statute and in proceeding where district attorney appears on behalf of state in positions of DHS and state are not in conflict. Since such provisions of the measure on June 30th, 2015, there is an emergency clause on the measure. I don't believe we have an amendment before us anymore, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Erin. Okay, we did have a hearing on this last week, and we have received quite a bit of information about the consequences of what the bill addresses and that it's a temporary fix. So the bill is ready to move. Senator Farioli, are you ready to make a motion?
I am, Madam Chair.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I would move the House Bill 4156 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Madam Chair, recognizing the relatively close sunset date, that's under discussion.
Great. Okay. Senator Farioli has moved House Bill 4156A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Senator Farioli.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This has been explained to me as a work in progress. It's an ongoing situation. There's going to be further conversation. This is going forward with a relatively near-term sunset date, and we're assured that between now and the next regularly scheduled legislative session, there will be further iterations and clarifications of the rights and responsibilities under 4156. So on that basis, I'll support the bill.
Thank you. Any other comments? Okay. And we have a motion before us. Is there any objection to the motion? Okay, the motion carries. And I guess the chair is the only one who has not volunteered to carry a bill today, so I'll assign this to myself. And I'll close the work session on House Bill 4156A. And I think we don't have anything else to take up right now. We completed our agenda, but we never know, given that rules never closes. So I think what we're going to do is recess. Okay. So stay tuned, members. We will be sure to get hold of you if we have another meeting. And with nothing further to come.
And, Madam Chair, we're still, unlike some chambers, are on 1 hour posting.
Correct. We are on 1 hour notice. So you'd have at least that. Okay, committee is in recess. Okay. Good afternoon and welcome to the continuation of the Monday, March 3rd meeting of the Senate Committee on Rules. And we do have one bill posted. I will open a work session on Senate Bill 1581. And Erin.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 1581, originally heard on February 19th, directs public universities and community colleges to increase voter registration access and information, prohibits public universities and community colleges from considering student voter registration when determining resident or non-resident status for tuition purposes. You have a -6 amendment. The amendment essentially replaces the whole bill. I will highlight the differences between the underlying bill and the amendment. It requires display of Secretary of State link during a primary and general election if it occurs during the academic school year. It removes the requirement that Secretary of State link be displayed on additional administratively controlled websites, requires that faculty member give permission to allow for classroom presentation and school provide professional contact information for faculty that is already compiled, clarifies that individual students may provide voter registration information in non-reserved public spaces on school property throughout the academic term, but does not impact non-registered students. Requires reminders sent to students be through email only, limits content of reminder, and removes prohibition against public universities and community colleges from considering student voter registration status when determining resident or non-resident classification for tuition purposes. We have a no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact on the -6 amendments.
Okay, thanks, Erin. And I see that Senator Hess is here in the room, who is the chief sponsor. Would you like to come forward? Good afternoon, and welcome to the Senate Rules Committee.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Senator Rosenbaum and committee. I was asked to introduce this legislation on behalf of the Oregon Student Association, and I did so because I believe in their goal of increasing student voter participation in public universities and college campuses in Oregon. For a number of reasons, there appears to be some barriers to doing this. This bill helps address those barriers in what I think is a practical way. It allows colleges and students to work together to register students and provide unbiased information about voter registration. If there is an onus on helping students find information about how to participate, it falls mostly on student governments, not on universities or college. That point was important to me. Students, as you know, are a highly mobile population, often moving multiple times a year. That's why it's extremely beneficial and helpful for them and for our democratic process to be able to keep their voting eligibility current. While some campuses do a great job of giving students these access points, most of that is granted through relationships with administrators rather than by certainty, and what students would like is assurance that they can do the basic, direct service of registering peers to vote on college campuses. These civic engagement activities fall in line with the missions on most of our campuses, as well as our own ideals of producing a highly educated and engaged citizenry. This bill specifically directs universities, this amendment, the Dash Sixes, directs universities and community colleges to give the school's student government opportunities to provide nonpartisan voter registration services during orientation programs, campus welcome week events, and residence life program activities. Dorm residents are historically the most unlikely to return a ballot or update their address, so it's important to reach out to these students. This amendment also gives student governments the professional contact information, which is already compiled by institutions, in order to ask faculty members if they can come to one of their classes and talk about voter registration. It directs schools with students living on campus housing to engage local election offices and students to develop systems that help students receive ballots in a timely way. And lastly, this bill will ask campuses to remind students through email of important voting deadlines. And as a parent of a teenager, I can attest to the fact that you sometimes need to remind young people of important deadlines. That's all I have.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Senator Hess. Are there any questions for the senator? Yes, Senator Starr.
So thank you, Senator, for your testimony. Were you part of the folks that helped to come up with the Dash 6 amendments? I mean, were you instrumental in the negotiation or the...
Well, I was not. Okay. Not on the Dash 6. I just knew we needed to go a ways to get there.
Okay. I guess, want to ensure that in Section 5 of those Dash 6 amendments, that we're not in any way creating a system where ballots are going to be dealt with in a loosey-goosey kind of a way. That we make sure that ballots are actually delivered to students, not ballots aren't delivered to dorm rooms and somehow, you know, passed around without making sure that they go into individual voters. It's not your intention in any way that...
Absolutely not.
Yeah, thank you.
Any other... No? Okay, well, thank you very much for bringing this to us.
Thank you.
Senator Hess. And I believe that we, although we are in a work session, we heard this bill previously, but the amendment does replace the bill. So I think we have one representative from the Student Association that wanted to testify, if you'd like to come forward. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Chair Rosenbaum and members of the committee. My name is Beatriz Gutierrez. I'm a student at the University of Oregon, and I'm also the co-chair of the Oregon Students of Color Coalition. Thank you very much for giving us this opportunity to talk to you about the bill and the work session. It means a lot to us. I was recruited to to do nonpartisan registration my very first year at the university, and it changed my whole perspective on civic engagement. Registering to vote was my first step to actually being part of the democratic process, and it has also encouraged me to take on an active role in encouraging my peers to do the same. I was part of the team that organized the Vote, as you can see my t-shirt. We did a big campaign at the University of Oregon, and it was a really great experience, and we registered a lot of students, but we came into a couple of issues when it came to working with housing. We had to set up several meetings with administration, trying to find a way where we could work together in making sure that we are we're abiding by the rules. And it was difficult to have those conversations without a policy or a law to guide us by. Having a successful voter registration campaign is necessary when we're trying to create civic engagement in the student body. Because students move every year, and especially in the residence halls, we need to continue to contact those students to remind them to to update their voter registration. And just working with administration is one of the examples of how we struggle to register our fellow students. And talking to several campuses, that's not the only issue that there is when we're trying to engage our peers. There's also campuses that have even less access than the University of Oregon. And we really need this bill to ensure that all students in the state of Oregon have an equal opportunity to register to vote on their campuses. SB 1581 is crucial to continuing the nonpartisan civic engagement that we do across the state. This bill will help clarify the kind of relationship that administration, faculty, and students have. And we want to continue to have that valued partnership with stakeholders and be able to educate students about the voting process. The access points listed in the bill are a great foundation for students to talk to other students about updating their voter registration. To be able to engage in conversations with each other, we open up the doors to allow us to discuss important issues that are important and pertinent to students especially. This bill helps reinforce the communication between the elections office and the mailing offices, the mailing rooms and on the campuses, because it's important for the mailing rooms to be able to facilitate the influx of the ballots once election season comes. It's also, passing this bill will help campuses with the coordination and ensure the greatest engagement from the student body in the electoral process. Students are asking for this committee to vote yes on SB 1581 and with it a due pass recommendation to the Senate floor. Thanks again for your time.
Great. Okay, well, thank you for your testimony. Stay put for just a minute, and I'll see if anybody has questions for you. Are there any questions?
I have a question.
Yes, Senator Starr.
So thank you for your testimony. Were you involved at all in helping to craft the -6 amendments?
No, I wasn't.
Did we have anybody in the room that was involved in helping to craft the -6 amendments? Are we willing to talk to the amendments? Is that okay, Madam Chair?
Sure. Would you like to come forward? You can stay there.
Oh, okay.
Madam Chair, Senator Starr, for the record, my name is Mario Parker Milligan, and I'm the Legislative Director for the Oregon Student Association.
Madam Chair, may I ask a couple
questions?
Yes,
go ahead.
So I'm most concerned or most focused right now on Section 5 of the amendment, which is lines 9 through 19 of page 2 of the -6 amendment. Just talk a little bit about how you see that process working. There's just a concern about loose ballots that don't connect directly with a voter and how that transfer will occur. As I read this, I can see a situation where this actually makes that process work better. But I will tell you that there are folks that are very concerned about any time when you have ballots out and about and they're not directly in the hand of the voter whose name is written on that ballot. Just talk a little bit about that, please.
Great question. Chair Rosenbaum and Senator Starr, that exact part of the bill, of the amendments, come from an issue that students recognized in the last election cycle, where ballots were arriving on campus and mailrooms were not prepared to deliver them to students. And because there are students working in that, we were able to hear the issue of ballots being sent back to the elections office before they were delivered to students. So the intent of that section is to ensure that campuses are developing a system within their own institution to ensure that ballots are getting to the people that they're intended to be delivered to.
So, Madam Chair, just to follow up. So, I'm a sophomore at the University of Oregon, and I reside in room blah blah of such dorm. I don't know, whatever dorm it is. Mm-hmm. I'm fairly certain that when my mom sends a gift care package, it makes it to me. How is it that under the current situation that the ballot doesn't make it to that particular dorm number or dorm room or my mailbox or whatnot?
Mm-hmm. It depends on when that person moved in to that specific dorm room and when they updated their voter registration. So if they moved, and some folks, especially I know like Bea has a lot of experience with folks at the U of O, but folks sometimes move within that within the year from dorm to dorm. So I think, like, your question, can you repeat it one more time? Because
I think that, as a student, generally you get your mail.
Sure.
Package from home or whatnot, and yet we apparently, because we need to pass this bill, we need to fix the situation for ballots.
Yeah.
Ballots are, these treasured, envelopes that we want to make sure get to the person whose name is on it. We certainly don't want the ballot to be sent back, or we don't want the ballot to be cast by somebody whose name isn't on the ballot.
Mm-hmm.
Is it your understanding that Section 5, Sub A and Sub B, make that process work better, so that we make sure that that ballot gets into the hand of the registered voter?
Yeah, I believe it's the intention of that to ensure that it gets to that person and no other person. I know here in the state of Oregon, we do really good work to ensure that folks, that ballots get to the people whose name and the address that's on the registration form. And I know that when returning the ballot, you're supposed to sign it, the back of it. And if that signature doesn't match the signature that you originally signed up when you registered to vote, then the elections office will notify you and let you know that there is a discrepancy and they need you to contact the elections office before processing the ballot. I think if the person doesn't live in that room anymore, then it needs to be sent back, or if they are no longer attending that campus, then that's a ballot that's going to the wrong place. So, and the appropriate person is no longer on campus, so it should be sent back to the elections office. But if they are on campus, then the campus needs to work as hard as it can to ensure that it gets to that right person.
May I add something? I registered a lot of students, and when they're filling it out, sometimes their dorm number isn't what their mailbox number is. So they leave out that part of, putting their mailbox number, and it just gets to the building, but it doesn't get to, the specific mailbox that they need to be. So one thing is, the actual institution finding a way to look up, their name and being able to put a mailbox number to that makes it easier for them to it actually being delivered to the person than just being left in the mailroom and being sent back without being able to get in the right place, if that answers your present first mail ballot question.
Just one additional follow-up, Madam Chair.
Sure, go ahead.
It's my understanding that Senator Close was working with you on these amendments. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay, great. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Great. Okay, thank you for the questions. Senator Farrelly?
Yeah, Madam Chair, it's just a suggestion that you subcontract with whomever it is from the cities who is responsible for delivering to traffic ticket summons to students, because they never, never miss.
They don't.
They're really good. They always found me.
Yeah. Okay, thank you for the advice, Senator Farrelly. Any other questions?
Sorry for prolonging this, but I believe the law is that ballots cannot be forwarded. So you're not talking about forwarding ballots. So what are you talking about? If somebody's changed their address, mm-hmm. That means that you can't forward it. They'd have to re-register or send a new address. That's not what you're talking about, correct?
No. We actually do a lot of work to tell people, like, when they are updating their information, because some folks do ask that question. Well, my parents send it to me because they live in Portland. I go to school in Ashland, and we let them know, actually, you can't do that. That's illegal. Your parents can't forward or send a ballot through the mail. You can only send it to the elections office. So that's why you can maintain your voting residency in Portland, but change your mailing address to Eugene or Ashland.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Farrelly.
It's been, I went to school well back in the last century, so I'm sure this has changed. Aren't there resident assistants that live in the dorms that are charged with helping to manage the facility? And aren't they also responsible for knowing which students are in that residence hall? So, I mean, wouldn't that be a resource? Don't the RAs have something to say about how the mail is delivered in those facilities?
I don't think they have anything to say. I think they help the students in their, like, living areas, but I don't think they have anything to do with the way their mail gets to them.
I mean, it sounds like the way people get their mail is generally everybody has an individual P.O. box, right? Mm-hmm. And when you register to vote, you have to put down a physical address so that the elections division can tell you actually live in Oregon, and you then assign you to a particular state representative or state senate district or congressional district. So my guess is probably the confusion comes about because people don't always write their P.O. box, which is mm-hmm. where it would have to be delivered to. And so it seems to me it's sort of a two-way street, that when you guys are registering people, mm-hmm. you want to make sure that people are filling out all the information they need mm-hmm. on their registration card. But then, I mean, my reading of this language of the bill is that it calls for a check-in prior to the election with the county clerk to make sure that there's not, like, thousands of ballots out there with no P.O. box or non-existent addresses. I don't think it could require anybody to change their mailing address either. People will have to know to update their mailing address if that's what they need to do. So no one's going to go around hand delivering these ballots yeah. to students in the residence halls.
Yeah, no.
We have that on the record, Madam Chair.
Well,
that's what I needed to hear.
Okay, great. I don't see any other questions for you, so thank you again for your testimony.
Thank you.
And members, we are in a work session.
So, Madam Chair, do we have anybody from the university system that's willing to testify to their support or neutrality objection to this amendment?
Okay, we did have testimony from OUS at our previous hearing, although it was not on this version of the bill. I do see representatives of the community colleges.
I would just be curious to know if they're neutral or if they don't care.
We don't have any. I don't think we have anybody here from OUS, but we do have somebody from the U of O and community colleges.
If you don't mind.
Sure.
Thank you.
Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Wyckoff. I'm the legislative director for the Oregon Community College Association. And we worked with the Oregon Student Association to work through our concerns with the previous versions of this, and are neutral at this point, and feel comfortable with the new language in here, and that we will be able to fulfill what are some of the mandates. And some of the stuff that we were originally concerned about is permissive in this version, and we feel we can fulfill permissive mandates generally.
Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Hans Bernard with the University of Oregon. The University of Oregon has concerns with the language as it is presented in the A6 amendments. We, at this point, feel the language is fairly prescriptive and directive to the campuses, and would have some concerns. We would be more than happy to work with the Students Association during the interim to address some of these issues, but at this point, we have concerns about the way that the A6 language has been presented.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Questions?
Madam Chair, it's deeply satisfying to me that at least some of the university community is opposed to this. I just think that's the appropriate relationship between students and institutions.
Okay, thank you, Senator Farrelly. Thank you for your testimony. I can tell you were a rabble rouser in your youth, Senator Ferrioli. And you still are.
Madam Chair, I was one of the first Oregonian generations to be pepper fogged at the University of Oregon.
Ah, me too. What year?
69 to 73.
Me too. Whoa.
I'll tell you where I was in 69.
Okay, so we are in a work session.
Madam Chair, I move that we adopt the dash 6 amendments to Senate Bill 1581.
Thank you. Vice Chair Ferrioli has moved the dash 6 amendments to Senate Bill 1581. Is there discussion? Is there objection? Amendments are adopted. Senator Ferrioli.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 1581 as amended to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Senator Ferrioli has moved Senate Bill 1581 as amended to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Is there discussion?
No, Madam Chair. I think we should enter the term passive mandate into our lexicon. Let us speak. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Ferrioli. Senator Starr.
Thank you. I will support the motion today, but reserve the right to change my vote on the floor. On the record, having the testimony that we're not going to be hand-delivering ballots is really important. That's a concern. If the ballot, we want to make sure the ballot gets to the voter, and that you don't have, you know, student groups or the administration or folks, you know, carrying ballots around trying to pass them out to the appropriate folks. I think that's problematic, and we had testimony on the record that that's not the intention of the bill. I'm a little nervous about it to a large degree. I don't know that the bill is ultimately necessary, but I will support the motion today.
Okay, thank you, Senator Starr. Further discussion? Okay, so we have a motion. Is there objection to the motion? Okay, motion carries. And since Senator Hess is the chief sponsor of the bill, we'll ask him to carry the bill on the floor. And I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 1581. And we don't need to recess. We can adjourn for the day.
Right?
Okay. Okay. Well, yeah. Members, I think that completes our work, at least thus
so
far.
Do we have a meeting tomorrow?
We do not have a meeting tomorrow.
How about one at 8 o'clock?
Well, if you'd like to have one, we could probably find something to do, but we aren't planning to meet.
Okay.
So, members, with nothing further to come before us, we're adjourned.
Sure. Could we move the signing die?
Oh.
I mean, we just sort of have it, you know.
9 o'clock.
Just sort of have it.
We'll speak to the presiding officer about that. We can always meet again. This committee never closes. So.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Thank you, and we're adjourned.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Thank you, and we're adjourned.